The Athletic.
Welcome to the Athletic Football Podcast. I'm Ian Irving, and as this summer's transfer window appears to have kicked into overdrive already, on today's show we'll be taking a closer look at how the Winter World Cup might be responsible. To do that, I'm joined by a couple of the Athletic's big hitters, senior writer Dom Fifield and our Spurs and England correspondent Jack Pitt-Brook. We'll also touch on some of the big news stories from the last couple of days and point you in the right direction of some essential reading before we're through. But Dom, let's kick things off. You've written a piece all about this on The Athletic at the minute. Essentially, is it all about regular game time for players ahead of Qatar now?
Yeah, essentially. I mean, footballers target World Cups. They see them as massive opportunities in their careers. They may only get one opportunity to feature for their country at a major finals like this. So the calendar is obviously a bit altered this year, given that the World Cup's taking place from November to mid-December. So the first 6 months or 5 months of the coming season are critical. Players need to be getting regular game time in that, getting a rhythm of matches, form and fitness together so that they go to Qatar with their national teams, peak form, peak fitness, basically, so they can hit the ground running and achieve what they want to achieve on that stage. Now, for most players, and there are key players at most Premier League clubs, I suppose, who will expect to be at that tournament, seasoned internationals. But for players who maybe don't feel quite as secure at their clubs and are not going to be, they're going to be on the fringes, they're not going to be playing every week. You know, they might be the players that feature more often in the League Cup than they do the Premier League, for example. Or they play in the group games in the Champions League and they don't feature domestically at the weekends. Those guys are going to worry about whether they are going to be in that rhythm, in peak form as they hit that tournament. And indeed, some of them are going to even fret about their selection for the final cut from their national sides as well. So that all comes into the thinking. And the summer window is their last opportunity to guarantee themselves game time if they feel they're going to be on the fringes of a major club or they're just not going to get the game time at their current team. So, you know, I spoke to a couple of agents on this and a couple of directors of football and at Premier League clubs, and they all anticipate a scenario this summer where you might get some players who normally wouldn't consider a move to, a lesser Premier League team or a lesser team on the continent. But because it's a World Cup year and because that tournament is happening mid-season, they might consider this move sideways, even back down, just to guarantee them game time to ensure they get to that tournament.
Yeah, and I guess the fact that it's 6 months away rather than 12 months away, it makes all of these decisions a little bit more pertinent, perhaps. I mean, Jack, we spoke a lot on the last podcast about Raheem Sterling and his future and the interest that Chelsea have in him. If people haven't listened to that, I'll point you in the direction of the podcast feed. It's an essential listen from earlier on in the week. But is he a classic example of a player looking for game time to guarantee himself a spot in the World Cup?
Yeah, I think so. I think Sterling has clearly been slipping slowly down the pecking order at City for at least the last 2 years, really. And while so far that hasn't affected his place with England, like, he's continued to be a really important first team player for Gareth Southgate, that doesn't necessarily mean that it would never do that. It doesn't mean that, you know, let's say, for example, if Grealish had a great start to the next season and Foden and Saka and maybe Marcus Rashford started scoring again, then all of a sudden Gareth Southgate might start to think, well, you know, would I really keep on starting Sterling even if he's never playing for City? So I think In that sense it does make sense that Sterling might want to make a move where he thinks he will play more, because he doesn't want to be going into Qatar, you know, having barely played any football or barely scored a goal all season.
And Rashford's a good example to him, really, isn't he? And Jadon Sancho at Old Trafford as well.
Yeah, completely. Like, Rashford, between I reckon, if you look at the time between, say, the 2018 World Cup and the 2021 Euros, Rashford was arguably England's best player. Like, Rashford scored, I think, 8 or 9 goals in that time span, and was playing alongside Sterling and Kane in that front three, and was, you know, was scoring more goals than Sterling and was looking like a better player. But now, obviously, Rashford has fallen out of the pitch with Man United, which means he's not in the England squad anymore. And so I think Sterling will be thinking, hold on a second, you know, just because I'm in the team now doesn't mean I'll be in the team forever.
Those are quite experienced international players that we're talking about on that. Maybe not Sancho, but Rashford has got a lot of caps, and obviously Sterling's got 77 caps, I think, with England. One that intrigued me and the decision making that he will have this summer is Conor Gallagher. He's a young player who has not played in the Premier League for his parent club, for Chelsea. Has had on the back of a series of loans and a very successful one at Crystal Palace last season. I think he played 35 Premier League matches last season and got himself into the England picture, earned his first caps. He's now in Gareth Southgate's squad. He was for the Nations League debacle just finished. He, to all intents and purposes, is going back to Chelsea this summer to gain a place in Thomas Tuchel's first team. He believes in himself. He thinks that he will force his way into that thinking. He's got glowing reports from his loan spell, and Thomas Tuchel loves him from what he's seen. However, we don't know whether Conor Gallagher is going to necessarily hold down a regular first team place at Chelsea.
Well, and he's only got half a season, hasn't exactly. he, as well, to do that, which again makes it more urgent for
him. Yeah, so what does he do? If come the end of pre-season, he starts the first couple of Premier League matches, and remember the transfer window goes until the 1st of September, so it's pretty much a month into the Premier League season. If he's lost his place then, he's suddenly become a fringe player, and he's only looking at Champions League group games occasionally, League Cup ties, etc., before Christmas as his regular involvement. What does he do? Does he push for a loan move that will take him maybe up to January the 1st? Or does he push for a year-long loan with a break clause in the middle? Or does he just take a year-long loan just to get that game time again and make sure that he has matches, whether that be at Palace, whether that be at Everton, wherever? You know, there will be interest out there in taking him on. But it's a real dilemma, because this is a kid who sees his long-term future at Chelsea, but the World Cup being in mid-season this winter has almost made him concentrate his mind and think, well, if I don't make it, what am I going to do now?
And I guess part of the problem would be, let's say Chelsea want to have Gallagher there as, you know, as competition, as backup, whatever, for the season. Yep. And then we get a few games in and it's clear that he's not going to play much. And then Gallagher goes, hypothetically, if Gallagher were to go to Chelsea and say, look, I want, you know, 6 or 12 month loan to mid-table Premier League team here. I don't really see what incentive Chelsea have got to say yes.
True.
You know, Chelsea might just say no, because why, you know, they want him around in case Mount or Havertz or whoever gets injured. So I think it's going to be really, really tough unless players are going to, you know, put their foot down now, I guess.
And if you listen to Thomas Tuchel over the course of last season, when he was asked about Gallagher, every single time he was asked about him, it was always, he responded with a sense of regret that he wasn't there. He wanted him at that club. So it almost seems inconceivable that he would sanction his departure on another loan move come September. But, you know, this is going to be a little conflict almost, potentially. I mean, look, Conor Gallagher might be brilliant at the start of the season and fully justify his inclusion in Chelsea's first team. I think he's got the quality to do that, but there's a risk involved.
Yeah, and it's an example, isn't it? Take away his name, put another name in, there are other players in this sort of situation. And it's interesting to hear international managers talking about this issue as well. You mentioned in your report, Dom, about Roberto Martinez and warning players that moves elsewhere could be detrimental to their chances of making the World Cup if you don't hit the ground running at their new place, and the effect that it can have on a player's all-round game and their state of mind and everything else. Also, Louis van Gaal, Jack, has been extremely outspoken about Jurrien Timber in particular and a potential move to Manchester United.
If he went to somewhere like Manchester United and maybe did not play in the first team straight away,
then
his World Cup hopes in December.
Then he's not so wise, I think.
To go to Manchester United?
Yes.
Thank you. Jochen
has to play.
Warning him that if he goes there and doesn't play regularly, he's not going to be in his team for the World Cup. I mean, there might be something personal, perhaps, between Van Gaal and Manchester United. But again, it's an example of an issue that an international manager is saying this sort of thing to a player.
The Dutch national team is quite an interesting one, because they've obviously got some very good players who grow up in Holland and then, you know, maybe come to England or other countries, and sometimes they go on and be big stars, but then sometimes they don't. And I mean, a really good example of that is Steven Bergwijn. You know, Tottenham bought Bergwijn from PSV Eindhoven, 2.5 years ago. And he's obviously a very talented player, but he's not really had a run in the Spurs team, certainly not recently under Conte. And he every time he plays for Holland, he does really, really well. But equally, I think he's a classic example of a player who must be thinking, I've got to be playing more football before Qatar. I don't want to fall off the radar. So Ajax tried to buy him in January. Tottenham couldn't quite agree a deal with him. Ajax, I think, are back in for him again this summer. I think it's, to be honest, best for all parties if Bergwijn does go to Ajax this summer. But I bet Van Gaal, there must, you know, for every, but underneath Bergwijn, there'll be, a, you know, half a dozen other players who Van Gaal must be thinking about. You know, some of these guys do, these guys need to be playing football in the next 6 months. You know, now is maybe not the best time to go and take a gamble about going to Man United. And for a lot of them, maybe it does make sense to take half a step down just to make sure that they're playing football between now and November.
Nathan Aki is another Dutch player, Dom, that you wrote about.
Yeah, look, and he's had a bit part filling in role at Manchester City really since he joined there. I mean, he's never going to be a first team regular. I wouldn't have thought, as in, you know, the first name on the team sheet when it comes to the back line. So, I mean, he will presumably want first team football somewhere, and there'll be no shortage of interest in him. He's a player that will have suitors, and he will be confident that he will be able to get game time if he's allowed to leave City. Otherwise, he's looking at what, 10 substitute appearances for City if they don't have injuries at the back between now and November, when the squads are allowed to have their 1 week's preparation ahead of the finals in Qatar. I mean, there are loads of them. I thought Martinez's comments were quite interesting. They were made just before the Nations League games took place, and I think a lot of people read into them that he was talking about youngsters like, I think it's Charles de Ketelera, who's at Club Brugge, and has been linked with a move abroad, and he's playing regularly there at Bruges, and if he went abroad, maybe he wouldn't get that game time at the start of the season. But it equally could apply to a player of top quality, established quality, like Yuri Tielemans. I mean, that's a player who's entering his last 12 months of his contract at Leicester City. Again, no shortage of suitors. People want him. He's a quality player. But does it make more sense, certainly for Martinez and possibly for Tielemans, to stay in an environment that he knows, he understands, he knows he's going to play, he knows the system he's going to play, and he knows he'll excel at it because he's a very, very good player, and do that for the next 6 months, effectively for 12 months for this final year of his contract? Or does he risk it and go and try and break into a new system, in new surroundings, possibly in a new country, a new culture, and these sort of unsettling effect that might have on his football, you know, in the 5 months leading up to the biggest tournament potentially of his career? I mean, it's, when you put it in that way, there's a logic to what Roberto Martinez is saying: stay put, concentrate on getting your club form right, so you can go to the World Cup and excel.
Tielemans is a really good example of why it might pay to be kind of risk averse at this point. Like, it's not really a good time for players to be jumping ship and trying to jump upwards, if you know what I mean. Like, it makes sense to take a sideways or downward step. Like, for example, I mean, you know, people might disagree that saying going from Tottenham to Ajax is a downward step, but in the kind of football economics food chain, it is a downward step going from Tottenham to Ajax.
Takumi Minamino is a good example of that at the moment as well, moving to Monaco. You'd expect that, I know he's not played much for Liverpool, but with his pedigree, you'd think that maybe a move higher than Monaco could be on the cards, but perhaps he's got an eye on guaranteed football, despite you writing, Dom, correctly, that he's got 17 goals in 42 caps, so it'd be a very brave manager to leave him out of the Japanese squad.
You'd get these sort of almost like outliers. I mean, there are people who are more regular for their international teams than they are for their club sides, and that's just the way it is. Maybe they're big fish in small ponds when they play for their countries, and they're small fish in big ponds when they play for their clubs. He played, I think he started one Premier League game at Liverpool last season. That was at Southampton, right in the run-in. 176 minutes of Premier League football last season, and yet he's, whatever happened to him, whether he goes to Monaco or not, whether he stays at Liverpool and remains on the fringes, he will be in the Japan squad. The issue that he'll have is that he will be rusty. He won't necessarily be in that sort of rhythm of games, and his fitness might not be what he'd want it to be in normally going to a World Cup. So that's the dilemma that he faces, and maybe that's what's persuading him that a move to Monaco might be beneficial.
Minamino, like, whether it's Minamino or Bergwijn or whatever, it seems more like this is a time to move down the economic pyramid of football rather than up it. Like, it would be a brave player to move up the economic pyramid now, because, you know, those are the moves where you never quite know how it's going to land. And it might not be the best idea to jump into an environment where you're going to be playing less rather than more over the next kind of over the next 6 months.
As a wider point, Dom, how important do you think the World Cup is in the amount of early transfer movement that we've seen across this summer? Do you think that's a key reason why deals have been sorted and so early? Or do you think it's the fact that the season starts early and you've literally got, what, 4 or 5 games in August before the transfer window even shuts and you want everyone in place early to get your preparations for the season straight?
I think for clubs, it's probably the latter. We've got a situation where EFL clubs are coming back to pre-season training this week. They start their season before the end of July, which, you know, I still can't get my head around, to be honest. It's bizarre. The Premier League a week later, and I think most Premier League clubs come back to pre-season training next week. So it's Monday the 27th of June, which again is remarkable. So managers and head coaches out there always want to work through pre-season with as many of the players that are going to be in their squad for the season ahead as possible. And I think that probably explains why the clubs that can and have the resources have been able to go out and do business early. I mean, talking about, I mean, Liverpool, Man City, whatever, they're the big ones. But Aston Villa, likewise, to a certain extent, Leeds United have gone out and got players early. Yeah. Tottenham Hotspur as well, as Jack would know. The agents I spoke to and the sporting directors were all sort of saying that they almost come into two categories, clubs. There are those that can do that because they have the money to do that and do their business early, and that's great because they're set up for them for the start of the season. And the others have to be more pragmatic. They approach it along the lines of, okay, player X is going to cost me so much now, but if I wait 2 weeks, that price might come down, and it might come down a bit, not a huge amount, but it will come down a bit, and that will give us more scope to add to our squad elsewhere. So we wait and we wait. And that's why you see a lot of the middle-ranking to lower-ranking Premier League clubs who maybe want to fine-tune rather than completely revamp their squads. They'll probably end up doing their business late anyway. So it may well be that August is a bit of a frenzy and that we don't actually see a squad that is reflective of what a team and squad will be over the course of a season until September the 2nd, basically.
Yeah, Jack, that is an interesting aspect as well. The fact that these clubs could have played 4 games, 5 games, whatever it ends up being, and have a real chance to look at what they've got before the transfer window shuts, because some seasons you might only have a couple of matches and that's it, whereas this really gives you a true sense of exactly what you're going to need if you don't already know it.
Yeah, and of course there was that. Am I right in thinking that, what was it, we had 2 years, was it, Dom, of the window shutting before the season started?
Right. Yeah.
Which I think was one of those things which was a really good idea in principle, but ultimately unworkable in practice. Like, I think it is a really good idea
because of Europe as well, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, yeah, it just made the English clubs vulnerable.
We are interconnected to European football completely. But I do think, morally and principally, it is much better to have it that way around. You know, to stop, to have no transfers during the course of the season because it distracts players. I think it's also kind of vaguely unfair on fans to have fans shelling out £1,500 or whatever for a season ticket for a team that is a work in progress. I think it's really disruptive when you see players who are obviously like angling for a move at the start of the at the end of the window. They're pretending to be injured or whatever, so they can get their move. They go on strike, like we've seen it a billion times. I don't need to name names. But unfortunately, it's not really workable unless everybody in Europe works in unison on this. If other countries are not going to work in unison on it, then obviously England has to kind of step back into line with the European leagues. Unfortunately, we're going to get a very long kind of lag at the overlap at the start of the start of this season and the end of the window. I imagine lots of teams will be thinking, "Hold on a second, this new guy we bought is rubbish, isn't he? This new right back's terrible. Have we still got any of the phone numbers for those guys that we nearly thought about in May?"
Yeah, you can see that happening quite easily, can't you? Dom, another aspect of the piece I wanted to talk to you about was it's not just a consideration for the players, is it? The impact that the World Cup's going to have being in winter. Also, you wrote about the club directors and heads of recruitment who are looking at new, different ways to do loan deals and short-term deals with players, with an eye maybe on the fact that these players want to move for the World Cup.
Yeah, the short-term deals are probably for players whose primary aim and ambition is to feature at the World Cup, and they may be out of contract now. And I'm talking, I mean, they're really exceptions, that the people like Gareth Bale and Dani Alves, who's just being released by Barcelona for a second time, and there are clubs in Brazil that might take him on to play the second half of their season, which would lead up potentially to for a 39-year-old to make the Brazil squad for Qatar. Bale's situation is well advertised, and we've written about it extensively on The Athletic. The loan deals, there was a sense, I think, amongst recruitment people and agents, that this summer might sort of see the loan numbers drop a bit, that we would get to a situation that this was all to do with the restrictive finances from the pandemic, and that people were having to be pragmatic and find innovative ways of bringing players in on short-term basis during that two-year period, and that this year there would be a lot more permanent deals and that money would be spent more regularly. As it's transpired so far, that hasn't really materialised. And so we're still in a situation where you're getting season-long loans with obligations to buy and make them permanent at the end, or season-long loans with options. You've got bizarre situations like Romelu Lukaku going back to Inter Milan for a hefty loan fee. But, you know, in the context of the transfer fee that brought him to Stamford Bridge last summer, I mean, it's minuscule.
Huge pay cut as well for Lukaku, it sounds.
To make it work. I mean, it just shows the desperation that he had to leave Chelsea and go back to Inter Milan and try and thrive there. And possibly with the World Cup in mind on that front as well, although I suspect there were other reasons, and his state of mind, he needed to get back to somewhere where he knew he could do well when he was comfortable. But yeah, clubs are having to explore those options, and I mean that's happening everywhere, and it creates problems, solutions and so on one point, but also problems, because you're getting scenarios. One that was relayed to me was that there was a player at quite a big European club who was being chased by a Premier League side for a loan for the year with an obligation an obligation to buy for a set amount, and the selling club is paranoid that this particular player is going to have a brilliant World Cup, and the deal they strike for him now is going to make them look stupid come next summer because of the fee.
There's another aspect.
They're having to take all this into account, and it's making negotiations more complicated, more intricate, but actually quite more entertaining and fascinating, to be honest. There will be some really, really clever and creative ways of getting these moves done before the window closes, that's for sure.
Jack, in terms of players moving and sort of, like Dom's saying there, maybe people making moves that you wouldn't necessarily expect, or in ways that you wouldn't necessarily expect. I mean, Gareth Bale, just to home in on one example, his situation, leaving a club like Real Madrid after what he's done there, okay, he's not played as much in recent times. He had the loan at Tottenham as well. But there's been reports even that he could even play for Cardiff in the Championship just to ensure that he's okay and ready to play for Wales at the World Cup. What would you do if you were him?
I think Bale's a rare, maybe a unique example of a player who, from the outside, it appears as if he has basically deprioritised his club career, not just over the last few weeks, but really over the last few years, with the goal of getting Wales to the 2022 World Cup, and also to the last Euros, which he successfully did. Real Madrid pulled the plug on his move to Jiangsu Suning in 2019, so that's 3 years ago, since when he's barely been a Real Madrid first team. He's had 1 year out on loan at Tottenham, where he played a little bit. He's clearly, you know, if he cared more about playing club football all the time, he could have made that happen. He obviously hasn't done that. So I wouldn't expect him to. I think he's a player who is not desperate to be playing once a week, even twice a week, for his club between now and the World Cup. because, you know, he's Wales' greatest ever player. He's not suddenly going to find himself out of the team if he's not playing football. And that means, I think, something like Cardiff does make sense. Like, he just want, you know, a comfortable environment where he can train and stay fit and play a bit when he needs to play. But not, I can't see him going back to another elite club. I can't see him going back to a sort of Real Madrid or Tottenham level team. It just doesn't really make sense. But equally, I think there's not many other players like that out there. I mean, you mentioned Dani Alves earlier. Maybe Dani Alves is a similar example. But even then, I imagine Dani Alves probably needs competition and to prove himself more than Bale does. So I think Bale is the one guy that really stands out from all these examples we've looked at.
Do you not think there's any damage at all, Dom, to him stepping down to championship level in terms of being ready for the World Cup from his perspective and playing at a level that he needs to be ready to lead Wales into that tournament?
Well, no, not really, because he's not playing much as it is. So I think anything he played at Cardiff City in the championship would be better than, you know, being on the fringes at Real Madrid and getting the odd 5 minutes here and there. In amidst the golf that he's playing over there, so I mean, I think there's an emotional tie as well with Cardiff, isn't there?
Yeah.
I mean, I think that would actually be quite a nice story, really, and it might get his juices flowing to a certain extent. I should probably, you know, caveat all that with, I don't think if he went to Cardiff City that and say Cardiff City had 24 games between now and November, I don't think he'd be playing in all of them. I mean, he might make double figures just about, but I mean, I can't imagine that Gareth Bale is going to be playing Saturday at Cardiff in the Championship. I think he would manage his workload quite shrewdly and quite cleverly, and I think any team that brought him on would probably have to take that into account when they're negotiating the contract with him, because, you know, maybe do a pay-as-you-play or something like that to get him in the door. I don't think he's, with the greatest of respect, I don't think Gareth Bale is going to be prioritising a Tuesday night away at Rotherham United in the Championship in the build-up to the World Cup. But, you know, it's maybe I'm being unfair on him. Maybe I'm definitely being unfair on Rotherham United. I think it would be an innovative, creative and clever move.
Would there not be Premier League clubs interested though, Jack?
I don't want to say no, but
your face is saying no. I know people can't see that. But
well, as Dom says, it's not like you're getting a Gareth Bale who would be desperate to win every game and go in for every tackle. Like, I don't think the issues with Bale's, I mean, look, it took Bale a long time to get up to speed when he was at Tottenham on loan last season, or the season before last. So I don't think he could instantly come in and beat and hit the ground running. I also don't think he could be a very effective impact sub, because he would need that time to get fit. And if you're playing, like, Premier League football is so physically quick and it's so intense. And also the calendar is ridiculous between now and the World Cup. Like, there's lots and lots of midweek Premier League games, there's midweek European games, Carabao Cup, all the rest of it. So I just think that if you were a Premier League team, let's say Southampton, his old team from a long time ago, and you got Gareth Bale, you wouldn't be getting, I just don't think you'd be getting a Gareth Bale who would be desperate to bust a gut twice a week for the team and all the kind of complex pressing instructions and the very high pace of the football and opposition right backs who'd be jumping into tackles, risk and, you know, at risk of injury. Given the way that Bale's really played over the last 2 years, I think it's not that I don't think he's good enough. It's that I don't think it would be sufficiently high in his priorities that it really makes sense for a Premier League team. Because I think you wouldn't be getting a Gareth Bale who's desperately motivated to win you games. You'd be getting a Gareth Bale who's thinking, about Iran, England and USA in Group B at the World Cup. And how am I going to stay fit? How am I going to, like, time my training in order to peak at the right time, all that kind of stuff. Like, I think that's just the reality of the situation as I see it.
Of course, all the latest on Gareth Bale will be on The Athletic, so keep your eyes peeled for news on his future. But we're going to take a look at another case study. This one not a player, this one from the boardroom. Chelsea have now confirmed the news that David Ornstein brought us on The Athletic on Tuesday, that Marina Granovskaya will be departing Stamford Bridge. It's also been confirmed that Todd Bowley will be the interim sporting director for this summer transfer window. And Dom, I wonder how much you think this will affect Chelsea in this window.
Well, she's effectively been running the club, certainly on the recruitment side, for pretty much a decade now. She's built up the contacts. She knows the movers and shakers, etc., from within football and the industry. And so she was a real asset for Chelsea. However, she was only an asset if she was allowed to do what she was good at, which was the negotiations. And I get the impression that maybe that isn't what's been happening quite so much since Bowley Clearlake took over at Chelsea over the summer. They're taking a sort of hands-on role when it comes to recruitment, and you know, they're relying more on what Thomas Tuchel is pushing for, you know, the type of players that he wants in the squad. And it hasn't reaped too many rewards yet, but I suspect there's quite a lot happening behind the scenes. And there will be a rush of Chelsea transfers before the start of the season. I think everybody anticipated Granovskaya being in situ this summer, possibly through to the winter window, but primarily this summer, because it would help the transition. It would allow somebody who had those contacts to bring in the players and what is quite a big summer for Chelsea, because you know they've had high profile people leaving the club. And they've got a lot of work to do in terms of recruitment. But clearly, the first few weeks of Bowley Clearlake at the club and Granovskaya being there, it hasn't... The dynamic hasn't been right. I mean, that's the only conclusion you can draw from this early departure. It probably is quite significant, and we should acknowledge the fact that Chelsea have announced that Marina Granovskaya will be available to Todd Bowley to help him out during the current transfer window for advice, etc., and support him over, you know, as he attempts to sort of negotiate an unfamiliar market. So we shouldn't just concentrate on some of the what would be deemed failures, effectively, of the last few months of her tenure. I mean, people will always pick holes in Chelsea recruitment, as they do in any club, and there have been difficult times, most notably under Conte in the summer of 2017. When they bought a lot of players. I mean, that was a sort of Danny Drinkwater summer, Tiemu Bakayoko summer. Of late, I think losing Christensen and Rudiger on free transfers, that's not good. That's not clever business. So that counts against her. And obviously the Romelu Lukaku fiasco counts against her. And I think there's a lot of culpability of that in all sides. Tuchel, Lukaku himself. She built up a reputation within the industry of being a very, very good and tough negotiator. If you talk to people within football who dealt with her, they were almost entirely full of admiration for the way she operated and respected her for what she brought to Chelsea Football Club. So let's not get completely tied into the failures of the last few months. She did do a good job at Chelsea overall, I think, and she will be missed to a certain extent. But, you know, at some point, every club has to move on. Chelsea will still attract players. You know, they finished third, they're in the Champions League. They got Thomas Tuchel as coach. They've got some very, very good young players within the setup there. They will be fine. There is always a sense of panic, and it's sort of heightened by social media, I think, when clubs aren't being seen to be doing business every single day of the summer. It's these things take time. It's going to take a bit more time because we've got a completely new regime in control of that club who are learning how the transfer market works. Let's judge it on September the 2nd. On the face of it, it looks a strange time to be, you know, to be losing somebody who's been your main negotiator for a decade. But I think we can only judge it on September the 2nd, really.
I mean, obviously Chelsea will miss her expertise, and it is very difficult for a club to lose a person like that. You know, we've seen, I mean, it's not a perfect comparison, but we saw it with Man United and David Gill, for example, when they lost Gill and Ferguson at the same time in 2013. Like, those kind of contacts and authority, they are very difficult to replace. On the other hand, from what you might call an optics perspective, she had to go, right? Like, she couldn't have stayed. You know, the reason that Chelsea being sold is because Abramovich was sanctioned by the UK government and by the EU because of his closeness to Vladimir Putin. Ganovskaya's whole career is based on her closeness to Abramovich. Ever since, all the way back, you know, long before he bought Chelsea, back in the Sibnef days, the idea of having Abramovich, you know, this sale was forced by the UK government. The idea of having Abramovich's main lieutenant at the club, no matter how good she is at her job, and I genuinely don't have a view on that because I don't know enough about the situation, but it would have just been completely untenable, like from the, you know, from what you might call an optics or PR or even a moral perspective, to have Granovskaya and Bruce Buck, Abramovich's main lieutenants, continuing to work at the club under the Bowley-Clearlake era.
Yeah, I quite agree. I mean, it was always going to happen. The only doubt, I think, people's minds was, could they stretch it out a bit so that they could get through this transfer window? And, you know, you're right, on a moral level, that's there's no debate there. I mean, there was always going to be a clean break. There was always going to be a clean break. I mean, look, Bowley and Clearlake will want to run Chelsea in the way that they want to run Chelsea. They won't be running it in the same way that Abramovich's people did. And we also have to take into account that Marina Granovskaya might not have wanted to have stayed in situ if she wasn't going to be able to do the job that she'd been doing under the previous regime. I mean, she may well have wanted to go as well. So I think it is a natural parting of the ways, and it is right, and it allows the new regime to put their own stamp on the club and make it what they want it to be.
And even if you take the kind of Abramovich-Putin angle out of it, this is an issue which in other takeovers you do see quite a lot, which is that you don't pay billions and billions of pounds for a football club and then necessarily want the people who have run it before to continue to run it. Like, so the Steve Parish Palace example, obviously the numbers are smaller, but that's actually quite rare in the sense that the investors have continued to allow Parish to run the club. But there's certainly been other clubs where, you know, that there's been talk of investment, and then the question has come up, well, do we let the old guys continue to run it, or do we bring in a new broom and sweep them away and run it ourselves? So this is, even aside from the kind of Abramovich context, this is a really common issue I think you do get in a lot of takeovers. And it's just a kind of bigger story in this case because of Abramovich and how everything that's happened in 2022 so far.
The very fact that we're now on Wednesday morning and Chelsea have, you know, confirmed the departure of Marina Granovskaya, but also confirmed that Todd Bowley will be acting as this interim sporting director until they name a full-time replacement, and it'll be on him to, you know, to continue the recruitment, or, yeah, to kickstart the recruitment effectively in this transfer window. That is an indication of where Chelsea are at the moment. They will be looking for a long-term replacement. They will be looking for somebody to come in and become the technical director, sporting director, whatever you want to call them, to oversee their recruitment department. But as with their player recruitment, they're in a situation where they're having to improvise at the moment. And with a new regime in control, it's now falling upon Todd Bowley, who's not really got a lot of experience at all about negotiating football transfers, to oversee what will be quite a major overhaul this summer.
Yeah, it'll be certainly something to keep an eye on, won't it, for all of us? And of course, you'll have all the best of the coverage on that. You can read more about it on The Athletic right now. We're just going to round it back then to the crux of the issue that we were speaking about on this podcast, and that's the effect that the Winter World Cup will have on this summer transfer window. And one of the issues, Jack, that we didn't talk about at the top, and I just want to finish with, is how much of a consideration it will be for clubs about the numbers that they need in their squads, how they may keep open loan slots as well, because like you said at the top of this, there's a lot more matches, a lot quicker. The schedule between August and November is really, really tight. I just wonder how much of a consideration that will be from the club's perspective.
I'm sure that clubs will err on the side of getting more players through the door this summer, or having more players in the squad for next season.
Bigger squads. You know,
yeah, bigger squads. The schedule is ridiculous. Like, it's completely ridiculous. Like, you know, we're having, what, all six Champions League group games, then an eight game window. There's a League Cup round 3 days after the World Cup final. There's a Premier League round on Boxing Day 8 days after the World Cup final. So the schedule is absurd. There's also the five subs rule to think about next season, which means that there's a better, it's better to have more good players. Like having a bigger squad is going to allow you, even more helpful to you week on week, or sorry, game on game, than it was in the past. So I think a lot of clubs will think, oh, you know, that 19-year-old we were going to loan out, let's keep him in the building for this season, or this kind of guy we can get on a free, not that good, but let's just get him in because, you know, you never know if this guy might get injured, or he's got the World Cup coming up, which means his mind's not going to be on it, or maybe they'll be thinking about the second half of next season, which we haven't really talked about yet, and they'll be thinking, well, if two or three of my best players are going to the World Cup semis, the World Cup final, and then they're going to come back and go straight into Premier League football when they're going to be physically exhausted and mentally drained, we're going to need some reinforcements. We're going to need some extra guys who can get on the pitch instead of the players who are going to be shattered post-World Cup. So I really think clubs are going to be definitely inclined towards more players, bigger squads for next season.
Yeah, the effect that the Winter World Cup's going to have on the second half of this season is definitely another podcast, Jack. So we'll save that particular thought for another day because there's a lot to that as well. But Dom, yeah, I wonder how much actually fringe players might not be fringe players then in this first period of the season.
We'll find out. I mean, part of me wonders whether there would be more scope for players to take six-month loans. So actually, say an elite club has got let's use Gilmore as an example. Gilmore's not going to get necessarily into the Chelsea first team, certainly at the start of the season, where they'll have a lot of midfield options. Is there a sense in loaning him out for the first 5-6 months of the season, so he gets a lot of game time somewhere else, and then when Chelsea attack that post, well, really from Boxing Day onwards, and the rush of games they'll have, as Jack says, well, they'll have players who are physically drained after the World Cup and definitely emotionally drained, because whenever somebody comes off a major tournament, they're always emotionally drained. And these guys would normally, in a World Cup, they'd have a chance to go off and have a holiday and then come back and ease themselves back in and start again. Exactly. So that's not going to be, they're not going to have that luxury this time. Could they then recall a Gilmore come January to come back into the squad and be potentially they could rely on him because he's had the game time, he's had the rhythm, he's got the form behind him, just to carry them through that little period in January, February time where some of the World Cup players will be shattered, and then hope that those guys re-energize for the run into their season. Look, I think all these things will come into clubs' thinking. They will be drawing up, the sports scientists will be drawing up plans, the recruitment departments will have to be thinking outside the box to try and work out how they make sure they have enough bodies in the building to see them through what will be an absolute slog of the season. Incidentally, a slog of a season on the back of 2 years of complete and utter slog over the pandemic of football played in weird circumstances. All of that will take its toll, and it will take its toll again this season. So I expect some wild and wonderful and creative ways that these teams and clubs will recruit and plan ahead.
Okay, well, if you want to know more about this topic, of course, you can go and read Dom's piece on The Athletic right now, How a Winter World Cup Will Affect the Transfer Window. But for the moment, thank you to Dom. Thank you to Jack as well. Jack has done a mailbag for all Tottenham fans as well, so go and check that out. Of course, you can find him on our weekly Spurs podcast, A View from the Lane, as well. And Dom can usually be found on the Chelsea Pod 2, straight out of Cobham. Remember, you can subscribe to The Athletic for just £1 a month. Head to theathletic.com/footballpod for all the details. But for the moment, thank you for listening, and we'll see you on the next one. Bye-bye.
The Athletic.